Welcome to our study. Today's date is October the 16th, 2015. Our study is entitled Gardenic Manhood. We are in series 34, study number 4. Of course, we're continuing with the theme which describes from Scripture the finishing of the gospel work. And today I want to point you to a familiar text, Matthew chapter 16, and we'll try to read verses 17 through 23. And Jesus answered and said unto him, Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Prior studies, we've taken great effort to show that Peter is symbolic of the final ministry, the tail end of the Christian gospel. We've also cited the point that the church, for the last 2,000 years, have never gained victory over hell's gates, which means they've never been able to escape the penalty of death. But as true as the Lord and His revelations are to our lives, we can have the assurity that the day is going to come when an antitypical Peter is going to emerge, and he's going to be presented with the keys to the kingdom. Let me just say that when Peter is given the keys to the kingdom, what he binds on earth is bound in heaven. What he loosed on earth is loosed in heaven. Means there are things to be loosened in heaven by Peter's authority. And it means that there are things on earth that Peter needs to bind. He has authority. The newness of the concept that we need to embrace and understand is that Peter has sovereignty over the kingdom. That's what the Lord promised. And some people are saying, well, I don't think that any man should have that much power. Well, Father thinks differently. I'm sorry to disagree with you. And the thrust of our study will expand the reasons why you may be misled to harbor that presumption. Now, let us continue. Because there was some follow-up events that occurred. Peter must have been joyous at the pronouncement. Oh, the Lord has affirmed my authority. Great. But then the Lord changed the subject. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. That statement, as we're going to see, was disconcerting information to Peter. Now, wait a minute. You mean the scribes are not going to be on our side? The Pharisees and the elders and the chief priests are going to be against us. What type of kingdom is this, Lord? I'm not so sure I want the keys to that kingdom. These are the in-crowd people. These are the people that all my life I've studied under. These are the people that I looked up with a glaze in my eyes and admiration. I presumed that these people had virtue and value to heaven. And now you say not only are they going to reject you, but they're going to kill you. You can understand what the scripture is conveying in the next verse. It says in verse 22, Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. Peter wasn't gentle about it. He handled the Lord. That's what it says. He took him. He was so shocked and jolted with the bruise that he received on his expectations that Peter took him and began to rebuke him. Verse 23, But he turned and said unto Peter, Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Too bad that Peter allowed Satan to echo his design through his lips. It's too bad that Peter and Satan were on the same team. It's sad to see that even an ordained disciple could be linked to Satan. And what's sadder than that is that the Lord told Peter to get thee behind me. But what we need to really understand is Satan and Peter's falterings. It says, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. How much reflection have you given on that statement? You ever eat a savory steak or steakette? You see? You ever let it your taste buds just take in all the delight so that you find it very joyful? Well, that's what Satan does. Not by virtue of the things that are of Satan, but the things that are of men. He says, thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Why do you suppose that both Satan and the church, remember we said Peter prefigured the end time church, why do you suppose that they savor the things of men and not of God? And why do you suppose that just before Peter's victory, he's afflicted with this same distaste for things of God? Why couldn't the church savor some of the things of men and some of the things of God? And why is it that the things that be of men are in diametric opposition to the things that be of God? Hopefully, as we advance in this theme of gardenic manhood, we'll be able to uncover the answer to these perplexing questions. You see, Satan didn't deceive men in this episode and with this charge and then promote that deception and thus receive the charge of condemnation. Because the charge is thou savorest the things of men. Satan took doctrines of men. Oh, you see this happening all over the globe now. This is why those sects of Jews that seek to control the world are dominating the world in their efforts through the Illuminati, through Masonry, because they've come up with delightful answers that the world rejoices in. And the only way that you can countermand those answers is by the Word. But you see, Peter was rejecting the Word. The Word said, I'm going to be crucified by the elders and the high priest. Peter said, wrong. You see, the elders, the chief priests, the rulers, the scribes and the Pharisees in all the years of study had presumed that when the Son of David came, he would be the Messiah, the Christ. And that he would give them empowerment over the globe. This is really what the misguided Jews of the world believe also. They're looking forward to the day when they can be seated in Jerusalem and empowered. They think that they could use Masonry to advance that cause. And those who trumpet the doctrines that they espouse because they've been popularized are those that have a satanic impulse. It's easy to control people if you could install a popular doctrine. And this is the reason why a father, as we're told in Isaiah 48 and many other places, Isaiah 28, Matthew 11, he hid his gospel from the wise and prudent and revealed it unto the babes. Who do you think that the populace is going to believe when doctrine is taught? The wise and the prudent or the babes? We know that they're going to believe those who are esteemed to be wise. Therefore, Satan rules the world by peer pressure. It's that same old nemesis that afflicted us when we were young. It continues on throughout the ages as we grow and develop. Peer pressure is his savory delight. It's not enough that the elders, in their egotism, would suggest that we really don't know who the Son of David is. We need more information, more understanding, and more light. In fact, the Son of David was supposed to be our light. We hope that he'll come and enlighten us. But rather than taking that approach, men do as they've always done, and they egotistically advance their own ideas. And the ones that catch on become popular, and they become cemented over time. And you may not be on the Lord's time schedule of education. It may take 1,000 years before the Lord decides to enlighten you. But when he does, then he needs for you to savor the things of God and not the things of men. And this is why we're so terrified by what people think about us, especially those in the church. They control our work. They control our prayers, our families, etc. Even when you get down on your knees and you pray with expectations of things that men have dominated your mind to expect. And the day is going to come when the Lord is no longer going to accept ignorance. But he is first going to unfold the light and the truth and give you an opportunity to embrace it. And then he'll be able to see the men who savor the things that are of God and those that savor the things that are of men. Now, the reason why, exploring this to a deeper dimension, why Satan savors the things that are of men, beyond the fact that he can control us by peer pressure, is because he knows that we cannot pass cross-examination. We saw when Job was put to the test, Satan conjured up anything that he could conceive in his mind to assail Job's faithfulness to the Lord. He said, he only serves you because you've given him so much wealth. Okay, we'll take the wealth away. Imagine that. The Lord says, okay, take the wealth away. Why not say, just mind your own business? Why not say, let me handle my people? No, because Satan was challenging Christ for dominion of the planet. And if Christ couldn't name one person that served him, that feared him, when I say fear, don't let that misconstrue your thoughts. It takes faith to fear. If you think that Christ is greater than Satan, and that's the theme of your life, then you're not going to fear Satan, you're going to fear Christ. You're going to be unwilling to offend him. Therefore, if there's an aspect of your life that's in the way, then Satan is going to present it, and it's going to be your test. He said, you put a protective hedge around Job. That's why he fears you. Okay, take the protective hedge away. Just don't touch his life. I mean, that was an amazing test. But it was designed to show us the extent of cross-examination. All he has to do for the saints today in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Davidia, all he has to do is say, if you approach them, Lord, with the scriptures and unfold to them a doctrine that is not popular amongst people, they'll curse you to your face. Consequently, for you and I as disciples to qualify into positions of leadership,
manhood,
we have to be able to surmount that claim. We have to show that we don't savor the things of man, but the things of God. I think of many examples. I'll just cite for you a few. You can't believe how intimidating it was for us to show that Jesus and Christ were different entities by Scripture. Oh man, we sweated almost pelts of blood mixed with water, right? I mean, it was an anxious moment for us to show that Christ was the dove that rested and abode upon Jesus and spoke through him. Of course, you're going to be assailed with insults and called a heretic and a blasphemer. But yet we saw that it was from the scriptures and we enjoyed it. We did not savor the things that were of men. We savored the things of God. Because Constantine ensconced among the Christian church the idea that Christ was the same as Jesus, who was the same as God. He gave to us this doctrine of the Trinity, three being in one, or God being a split personality, because that has prevailed for 1700 years, does not make it true. Yet you try to present it to somebody with a Bible open up before them and give them the opportunity to cross-examine it, they'll curse God to his face. See, it's all right if somebody opens up the scriptures and says, "Nay, my brother, you know, look what this says. I disagree." Then, even though the weight of evidence may not fall in your favor or in their favor, you still can't really excel them for holding on to their ideas. I'm talking about savoring the things that are of God and then dashing the things that are of men. The day is now upon us whereby we have this opportunity to choose. And the duality of Jesus, the fact that as Moses promised in Deuteronomy 18, that Christ would invisibly rest and abide upon Jesus and give to his people his testimony, that is now a doctrine that the world deems unsavory. The doctrine of the prophetess. That was another gut-wrenching doctrine to reveal. Doctrine of Enochian saints. It's not an easy one. It gets easier though when you get practice. The many themes of human sexuality, dress code, dietary liberal doctrines, family trouble. It's not easy for me to tell you all the problems that I got in my family. It really isn't. But I was reminded this week, my mission is not really to preserve the name of the West family or the Anderson family. My mission is to declare the name of the Lord. And if I do that successfully, all of these other things will fall into place. Therefore, as difficult as it is, whenever my kids do something ridiculous, I have to bring it before you and let you know. But with each advance of scriptural doctrine, I feel like that proverbial space shuttle, whereby the solid booster rockets have been jettisoned away, and we're going higher and higher to glory, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church is falling more and more quickly down to the earth. So it's a good experience when you learn to trust the Lord and to abide by his faith. And this is one of the afflictions of the church that has led to her demise, because she wants to continue to have large numbers to impress the world. She denies all unsavory doctrines, all doctrines of God. This has a little bit to do with the reprimand that the Lord gave to Peter. I'm turning to John chapter 21, reading verses 17 and 18. He said unto him the third time, "Simon, the son of Jonas, lovest thou me?" Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, "Lovest thou me?" And he said unto him, "Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee." And Jesus said unto him, "Feed my sheep. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself, and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee, and carry thee whither thou wouldest not." Here we see that Peter is symbolic of the church. Because why would someone have to carry Peter if he had the keys of the kingdom? And to boot, why would Peter point one way? "Thou shalt stretch forth thy hands." Over there, that's where we need to go. That's our evangelical mission. The Seventh-day Adventist Church are the people of our concern. We must, as the video has a fixation on this issue, we must use all of our energies and efforts to reach the 144,000 that are locked within the gates of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. That's nothing but impotent Peter pointing. The Lord tells him, "But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands." He's got less and less power today to direct the ministry. His ability to take the gospel to the church has waned. He can't even assemble all, when I say he, I'm referring to Davidia, can't even assemble together all of Davidia. This is what the Lord tells him, because he has this fixation on the savory doctrines of men. Because they were told that the 144,000 come from the Adventist church. That's what they want to believe. And that's the personality that militant Peter has. But the Lord is going to give Peter a triumph and a victory. He's going to have another, it says, when he's old, at the end of the Christian epic. Thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee, and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. The mustard seed is going to take the reins by the Lord's power, and is going to direct the gospel, the Adventist gospel. Going to direct it to the sons of America's former slaves. Peter shudders to think of that. You see, that's one of those doctrines that was very difficult for me to teach. But I have known some people that have told me directly that if that's the way the work is going to finish, I don't want to have anything to do with it. But they have no power to control the direction that the work is going to go. And it's going to be, I don't care what your unsavory thoughts are pertaining to that end time finishment of the gospel, it's going to be a glorious day. The problem with delivering unsavory messages is put in very simple terms. I like the way David put it. He said, you got to be a man. You see, you cannot be spiritually effeminate so that you're too limp to stand up on your feet and declare the name of the Lord. I don't care how big, vociferous, and ugly Goliath is. You've got to stand up and preserve the name of the Lord. 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. Now the days of David drew nigh that he should die, and he charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord thy God, to walk, to do what? To walk in his ways. We can continue on, but I've read enough for me to make the point that's caused me to come to this text. David said, you have to be a man. What does that really mean? Have you given much thought about what that means? What choice did Solomon have? They didn't have sex operations back then. Solomon could only be a man. It's showing you that David is using the term man proverbially. You cannot have authority in God's kingdom if somebody else is yanking your chain. If somebody else is leading you like a bull with a ring in his nose. You have to be a man. And not only do you have to be a man, but you have to walk in his ways. The problem with enfeebled old Peter. Peter militant. Somebody got to carry him. Somebody else has got to use their strength to haul him around. That's not what the Lord expects of us. He expects us to transport ourselves by walking in his way. And if you refuse to walk in his way, then he'll take your ability to walk. I'm not talking about literally, but spiritually, he'll take away your ability to walk. Paul spoke of this a little in Romans chapter 8, verses 4 through 8. He says that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us. The righteousness of the law, he says, might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh. And they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. For the carnal mind is enmity against God, because it's not subject to the law, neither indeed can be. So now, we see what it means. We have to be courageous. This is the way the work is going to finish. It's going to be finished by us proclaiming doctrines that are completely in disharmony with the themes that human beings have savored all these years. Let me read your reference. Testimonies for the Church, Volume 8, page 28. Transgression has almost reached its limit. Confusion fills the world, and a great terror is soon to come upon human beings. The end is very near. We who know the truth should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise. We who know the truth, she says, should be preparing. It takes preparations. You have to brace yourself. The only way that you could prepare is for the Lord to open up to you in advance the surprise. And when he does it, he knows that it's safe because everybody's going to laugh at you. Because it's unsavory doctrine to Satan and men. And this is why the mustard seed is on a mission to proclaim doctrines that are shocking and surprising. The mustard seed has a fervor to forward by flabbergast. The doctrines have got to be jaw-dropping, mouth-agaping, breathtaking. And this is the way you become a champion of God. Because remember, his doctrines are in diametric opposition to the doctrines that prevail in the earth. This is the point of creation. This is gardenic manhood. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over all the earth. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over everything that moveth upon the earth. That was God's design. It was his design that Adam and Eve would be the cult leaders, so to speak. That Adam and Eve would be the ones that would have preeminence. There are those who take the posture because they're smitten with Satan's savory salt. Take the posture that I don't believe that one man should be empowered. And as I told you earlier in the study, God believes it. He created one man to be empowered and to have dominion. Because you don't believe it is because you don't savor the things of God, but the things of man. The governments around the globe are in upheaval because they don't have a consistent form of righteous government. They need David's formula. You have to present yourself a man. You have to be a man. And you have to walk in the ways of God. It's funny that David made the statement in such a way. In fact, to quote him directly, he said, be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man. In other words, you've got to be open and bold with it. You can't do so incognito. You have to let everybody know that this is what your position is, that you're walking in the way of the Lord. And you have to be demonstrative in your doctrines. This is how you show yourself a man. You know that the world is going to mock, laugh, and jeer. And to show them, as the mustard seed has done, that although the doctrines may be laughable, they're unassailable, you have to be very tight with your scriptures. So that people who laugh, mock, and jeer don't have a true and just basis to do so. And this is why people want to know, well, you know, why do you take so long to give an answer? I'm trying to show myself a man. I'm trying to establish a doctrine that's controversial and encase it within a firm foundation of Bible gospel truth so that it's unassailable. And that really is an assist to me. And that fervor and intensity in my retort and my response is helpful because you're dealing with people that at least pretend to abide by the Bible. And it becomes more difficult for them to assail your teachings when they cannot use a Bible reference to condemn what you're teaching. In fact, David, as did Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob before him, pronounced a blessing on his seed. In Psalms chapter 1, he said, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. Why would anybody walk that way? Why would anybody walk in the counsel of the ungodly? Why would a man seek to stand in the way of sinners or sit in the seat of the scornful? You know why? Because they savor the ways of men. And the ways of men are enveloped in these adjectives. They're ungodly, they're sinners, and they're scornful. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. Verse 2. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law doth he meditate day and night. You see, there's controversy over the law. People see the law is a great burden. They see it as a great and enormous perplexity. It's not easy for the carnal mind to absorb the law. Paul said the carnal mind is enmity against the law. This is why the righteous man, the son of David, this is to emerge, meditates on it day and night. It's not an easy theme to put your arms around. Well, why does it got to be so complicated, some may retort? Why does it require so much intellectual consternation? I'll give you an illustration why. I've been married to my wife for 34 years. And I've been watching football and baseball all those years. And she still doesn't get it. She still doesn't get it. If she hears us jump for joy, she thinks it's a touchdown when it could just be a first down or a sack. There's a lot of reasons to celebrate. But the point is not to belittle the net. The point is that we master a lot of complexities. At the university, they have classes to teach women football. It's not the rules and the regulations and the modus operandi and in baseball, with her sister, she came here, and I tried to show her the difference between a curveball and a fastball. She couldn't even see it on television. See, if men could become experts, you got people that are paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year just talking about these sports. And people follow them and they know what they're talking about. They're very complex concepts. They're not easy to master. And I'm glad that Vinette hasn't put any energy and intensity into those pursuits. But if men can find joy in the mastery of these complex sports, why should God make it any more easy? He created the brain. Why should he make it any more easy for you to understand his law? If you could meditate on sports day and night, or if you could drive a car, if you could master the roadway so that you're going 60, 70 miles down the roadway and know how to perform, if you could serve the parameters that men have established and do so with full intellectual intensity, you get thrown in jail if you're driving under the influence of alcohol, then why can't you be a little bit more intense about your study of the law? But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind driveth away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor the sinner in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Advancing in our study, I should now make the point that the Lord promises that Elijah is going to finish the work. And that when he does, people are going to attempt to tell him how to teach his message. So we're advancing now into a theme that even deepens our study. We're trying to get a grasp on how the work is going to finish. Spirit of Prophecy tells us in Testimonies of the Ministers, page 475, a prophecy must be fulfilled. The Lord says, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Somebody is to come in the spirit and power of Elijah. And when he appears, men may say, you are too earnest. you do not interpret the scriptures in the proper way. Let me tell you how to teach your message. Many of us are very familiar with that reference from E.G. White, but I find that it's useful to a deeper degree as we advance in our study tonight. Let me first ask the ponderable, why use Elijah as an icon? Elijah was used as an icon because it shows a transition in theological doctrines. You see, Elijah taught Christology in the Old Testament. Elijah wasn't a Christian. He didn't have the benefit of the testimony of Jesus. Why is that a good thing? Why should the Lord, after all this effort that you have taken to point us to the testimony of Jesus, why now do you emphasize that Elijah is an icon? This is a theme that I've been trying to sort of articulate in a succinct way, and I hope that I can do so today so that you'll understand. You see, the testimony of Jesus represents ethics which belong not to Jesus and not to Christ, but to Father. Ever since Father in Genesis says, let us make man in our own image, ever since that time, you haven't heard his ethics. And now you make a distinction because you know that Christ is separate and distinct from the Father. Therefore, it seems sometimes that the testimony of Jesus disagrees with the Old Testament ethics. But the testimony of Jesus represents Father's tactical way to enlighten us in the Gentile age to save us. You know, David pronounced a blessing on the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. It says, he meditates upon the law day and night. There's a transition here that I'm hoping that you'll be able to understand before we're finished. You see, the law is going to eternally rule the planet. It's a law that brings us joy and happiness. It's a law that once you begin to learn and understand, it defines your salvation. It wins for you everlasting life. But it's a law that was not the focus of the testimony of Jesus. Because the testimony of Jesus does not manifest that the law was in error. The testimony of Jesus represents a limited time schedule for salvation. Oh, I know that's a lot for you to absorb, and you probably don't understand it yet, but I'm going to make it clear for you. First, let us substantiate some of the things that were said. We find ourselves spending time in John chapter 8. Let us revert back to John chapter 8, and hopefully you'll see this point contained therein. Verse 26 and 27. This is what the Lord said. I have many things to say and to judge of you. What do you suppose would have been the basis of his judgments? The law, you see. I have many things to say and to judge of you, but he that sent me is true. In other words, the truest form of salvation will be manifested by the Father's word. But he that sent me is true, and I speak to the world those things which I have heard of him. So, Christ is telling you that there is a difference between his word and the Father's word. Hopefully you'll get this. Verse 28, when ye have lifted up the Son of Man, then shall ye know that I am, dropping off the italicized word he, and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father hath taught me, I speak these things. He says that the day is going to come when you lift up the Son of Man that you're going to know his identity. We call that his name. And you're going to know that he speaks only those things that the Father taught him. Verse 44, he that believeth on me, believeth not on me, but on Him that sent me. You've been a Christian all these years. And the best that you could do, because you were a Christian, you didn't learn Christianity from any other source but from the testimony of Jesus. From the ordained disciples that were sent out to preach it. And the day is going to come when you're going to believe on Christ. And when you believe on Christ, you don't really believe on Christ. You believe on the one who sent Christ. And he that seeth me, seeth him that sent me. You had no idea about the Father until the mustard seed unfolded to you, the Father, because the mustard seed sees the Father. Because he sees Christ. He knows the name of the Lord. He knows to differentiate between the Lord, between Jesus, and between Father. I am come a light unto the world, that whosoever believeth on me should not abide in darkness. If any man hear my words and believeth not, I judge him not. For I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. You see, Christ did not come to judge the world. That's important. He came to save the world. And I use the world in contradistinction to just limit it to Israel. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. So, see, when you believe Christ, you don't believe Christ, you believe he that sent Christ. Because the Father delineated for Christ exactly what he wanted for you to hear. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak. For the duration of the testimony of Jesus, you heard Father's contribution to salvation. And without Father's contribution to salvation, you cannot have life. You're destined to die. Now we could go to our text in John 8, the one that we focused on in the last couple studies, and read verse 49 and verse 50. They called Christ a devil. He said, I have not a devil, but I honor my Father, and ye do dishonor me. And I seek not my own glory. There is one that seeketh and judgeth. Now, who made the statement here? Christ made the statement. Where did he get the statement from? From Father. Father told Christ to say this, which means that Father intended for us to understand that the day was going to come when the limits that were placed upon Christ to not judge would be removed. And that somebody else would come after him, Elijah, and that he would seek to uplift Christ. And that he would be given authority to judge. This is Peter triumphant, the one who has the keys to the kingdom. Christ didn't pray that he could keep the keys to himself. He prayed that Peter could receive it. Hopefully you perceive this very pivotal point. Because it shows you an expanded dimension of the gospel. And it shows you why Elijah must come. And why men are going to tell Elijah, you're not teaching Christianity. Here's the kicker. Turn the other cheek. Bless those that curse you. Hate your family. Love your enemies. Do good to them that hate you. Pray for those who despitefully use you. All of these things have an expiration date. They all represent Father's, not Christ's, will. He only does the will of the Father. He only articulates the themes that the Father commanded him to articulate. And this is why it seems like these themes are in disharmony with the Scriptures. And it's the reversal of this ethic. Because another comes to judge. Understand, he said, and I seek not my own glory. There is one that seeketh and judgeth. See, these themes that I articulated and many others seem like pleasant platitudes and peaceful purveyances. so that we can all join hands together in harmony and sing Kumbaya, my Lord. And so that we can all, you know, pretend like we're getting along and that we love each other and that everything is peaceful and nice. That's not the way that Elijah teaches the gospel. Elijah represents an icon that represents the reinstallation of Christ's administration. Maybe I've confused you. A reinstallation of the Old Testament ethic, the law, but presented in a joyous way because the Son of David has meditated upon it day and night. You all following me? See, Elijah seems to be out of sync with the Savior of the men of the church. This is why the Lord says, seek ye not after the meat that perisheth, but seek ye after the meat that the Son of Man shall give unto you, which worketh unto everlasting life. The day is going to come when the gospel dispensation over the last 2,000 years is going to be circumcised from the church. It's very important that it works this way. I know this is something that's perplexing and may require for you to give a lot more thought. But let us see if I can make it more clear and give you a greater perspective. Let me read to you some of the refrains that Elijah is going to establish. Now you know that Jesus told the disciples in Luke 24, verse 44, he says, these are the words which I spake unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses, in the prophets, and in the Psalms concerning me. Jesus delivered that message to the disciples, and he reiterated it after his ascension. He said, all the things that were written in the Psalms concerning me are going to be fulfilled. Let me read you some of the themes in Psalms. Psalms chapter 2, verses 2 through 9. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath, and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said unto me, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Elijah, you're violating basic and fundamental Christianity. It came with an expiration date. I'll show you why. That has to be in a minute. But the Lord says that he's going to issue judgment. He's going to speak through his anointed. He says, then shall he speak unto them in his wrath, and vex them in his sore displeasure. Chapter 6, verse 8 through 10. Depart from me, all ye workers of iniquity, for the Lord hath heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord hath heard my supplication. The Lord will receive my prayer. Let all mine enemies be ashamed and sore vexed. Let them return and be ashamed suddenly. Psalms 35, verse 1 through 6. Plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. Doesn't sound a lot like turn the other cheek, does it? Doesn't sound like bless those that despitefully use you, does it? Take hold of shield and buckler, and stand up for mine help. Draw out also the spear, and stop the way against them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. Let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt. Let them be as chaff before the wind, and let the angel of the Lord chase them. Let their way be dark and slippery, and let the angel of the Lord persecute them. The Lord promised to fulfill all those themes that were written of him in the Psalms. And I'm not going to read too much more because the hour is slipping away. I just want to cite to you Psalms 110. The Lord said unto my Lord, Christ said unto the son of David, Sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. Therefore you have the day when David is commissioned, before he's empowered, and he's told to sit in peace. And that's the day whereby Elijah's commission does not initiate. That's the day when you're at the tail end of the Christian ethic. That's the day just before the one emerges to seek to elevate Christ. Just before the day when he seeks after Christ's glory and is given the commission to judge. Remember, he said, And I seek not my own glory. There is one that seeketh and judgeth. I know that Jesus taught peace and love. He promoted love and passive forbearance. And his administration was established tactically by Father to validate my administration. Take a minute and reflect upon this point. How does Jesus' administration validate my work? It's because the world prefers the savor of men. And the savor of men is satanic. Well, how does that really illustrate the point that you're trying to make, Brother West? Well, it illustrates the point because it shows you that there was no other prophet, no other minister, nobody else in the history of the world that made it his business to teach to heal the sick, to raise the dead, to cast out devils, to calm the storms, to cure the lepers, to teach peace, love, and forbearance. That's what Jesus taught. And the church rejected Jesus. The Seventh Day Adventist Church began with the message. What was it? Let's go home with Jesus. From the Bible. And the world rejected it. They didn't want the Millerite movement to taught that Jesus was going to come again. So the door was shut to them. I said the door was shut to them, which signifies that they were no longer part of the dominion team. Their ministry could not bind in heaven what's bound on earth. Therefore, the Adventist ministry took hold and took over. And they began to teach Jesus more fully. They began to teach of the second coming. And the world rejected that dispensation of Jesus' salvation. So when the world rejects it, they say, we don't want our storms calm. We don't want our families fed. We don't want our dead to be raised. We don't want our devils cast out. That's why it says it's the council of scornful men. By rejecting Adventism, they rejected Jesus. But Adventism is the pinnacle of Christology. The Christian churches have a venue for salvation. But the door now is closed on Adventism because they've rejected Davidian Adventism. And Davidian Adventism rejects the return of Elijah. In fact, the Davidian Adventism, as well as Seventh-day Adventism, they reject the fullness of Jesus as revealed by the mustard seed. They want Jesus as revealed by Constantine. They want the triune Jesus. And now because they have turned their backs on the Lord, Paul says they crucified him afresh. They've manifested to the unfallen beings, and they've manifested to the Enochian saints that they don't want Jesus' salvation. So the doors of mercy are closed for them. They are removed. And they are removed because they have invalidated the thrust of Jesus' teachings. They rejected the fullness of his revelation. And now the message, the gospel, can go to the world by teaching to them about Christ. And the Lord can inundate the world with his glory. And they can receive and they can embrace Christ with the new light that's being taught. And therefore, they have ground to stand on in the judgment because they didn't know about Jesus or Christ beforehand. Those people that choose to refuse, they don't have to come. But the gospel is going to close with a dispensation whereby we're going to know when the Son of Man is lifted up in the earth, we're going to know that Christ is. They're going to be revealed the identity of Christ. They're going to know that He's the one that performed the miracles through Jesus. And they're going to have an opportunity to walk in the light and in the faith under the administration of David. See, beforehand, the idea was that Jesus would come and take everybody up to Him that was faithful and everybody else would be killed by the brightness of His coming. But now, we see from the revelation that we've focused on in the Garden of Eden, the Father said, let us make man in our image and let him have dominion. He commanded, be fruitful, multiply, and have dominion over everything that moveth upon the earth. You cannot receive the benefits of that blessing if you turn your back on it, as the Adventist Church has so done. They have rejected their sin offering. There is no remission for their sins. And now the message in power and in glory goes to the world. So, the final plan of the Father comes to fruition. It was Father that suggested that we make man in our image and that he have dominion. And now, after the epic of Jesus has subsided and he turns the reins over to Christ, Christ is reinstalled and empowered and he's ordained to be the God of the whole earth. Let me just close by reading to you in Isaiah chapter 54. Verse 1, sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, thus saith the Lord. Verse 5, for thy maker is thy husband. The Lord of hosts is his name. Jesus began the Adventist movement. He's the one that installed the Davidic movement. He's our maker. The Lord of hosts is his name. And thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth, shall he be called. So, Christ was not the God of the Gentiles. He was the Holy One of Israel. He was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the day is going to come when Jesus' administration comes to an end that he, Christ, the God of the whole earth, shall he be called. And that's when he is able to emerge and execute judgment on those detractors of his. Father has given them 2,000 years to come into compliance. There are those around the globe that want to kill Christians. Why? The Illuminati teaches from the Talmud, they've borrowed from the Jews, that Jesus is burning in hell. What did he do to deserve that? See, if you want Jesus to burn in hell, then you don't want the gift that Jesus proffered. He's only on record, he's not on record punishing anybody. He's not on record persecuting anybody. He didn't recommend that you take the sword to anybody. He said, love those who despitefully use you. And when you reject Jesus and he comes and he's exposed to the full fruition, then you reject those graces by Father's verdict. And this is the theme of Gardenic manhood. And this is the hour of his judgment. And with that, I bring the study to a close.